This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
If you've been feeling confused and as though everything is impacting on you all at the same time, this is not a personal, private experience. This is actually a collective experience.
There is a word for that. Polycrisis.
So polycrisis, for me, describes the production through the radical process of development itself of an expanding zone of new unknowns. So radical uncertainty is not simply a given, it's produced. It's a radicalization of modernity that we're actually facing. Mark Blythe, my friend Brown, puts it brilliantly in an article in The Guardian 2 years ago. As he describes it here, climate breakdown, of course, induced by human economic development, is a giant nonlinear outcome generator with wicked convexities in plain English. There's no mean, there's no average, there's no return to normal. It's one-way traffic into the unknown. So this is produced uncertainty. It's not a given. It's not a fact about the world. This is what I think the polycrisis term is trying to capture.
That is British historian and Columbia professor Adam Tooze speaking at the Overseas Development Institute Conference in 2023. You will hear more from Adam Tooze later in the program. But is polycrisis the right framework to understand these times? Also in this program, our health is damaged by climate change in more ways than we know. From the University of Bristol, UK, scientist Dan Mitchell points to the cumulative risks no one is counting. You need to hear that. First, can extreme climate-driven disasters change people's minds, even in right-leaning people? California Business School marketing expert Rafi Siddiqui answers. He reveals how they get you to buy more stuff. Knowing is the door to resistance. Do extreme events, from hurricanes to wildfires, wake people up about climate change? A new study out of California finds right-leaning people may change their views if hyper-disasters hit their state. Maybe this is an opening to move away from the culture of high consumption towards more earth-friendly ways. Our guest is Rafi Siddiqui, Assistant Professor of Marketing at Santa Clara University's Levy School of Business. Rafi got his doctorate in marketing. He specializes in what makes people buy things or not. From California, Rafi Siddiqui, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
There's been a lot of debate on whether climate-induced disasters will change people's minds, including maybe people who don't believe in climate change. So far, my take is that climate disruption has not been enough to prevent people from voting for climate deniers. But your paper is not at all about votes or elections. It's about buying habits. And so to get the right framing, Rafi, could you remind us why consumption matters so much to the economy and to our future?
Yes, of course. So as you can understand, it's our day-to-day decisions eventually which can have an impact on the environment. So from, you know, switching to less plastics and inducing habits in which we look for materials which will not harm the environment, day-to-day consumption matters there. And if we can switch people's behavior in that day-to-day consumption, then it can go a long way in preventing further harm to the environment from happening. Now, of course, there are considerations where a lot of times, for example, the sustainable versions of products maybe perform inferior, or sometimes they actually perform better than the regular versions of products. They might be more expensive, for example, or they might also be inconvenient. For example, paper straws is a good example. Like, they tend to not work as well as plastic straws, and people might not be able to enjoy their drinks as much if they switch to paper straws. So there are those challenges in convincing consumers to actually switch to sustainable products. The more we learn about the possible influences, the possible interventions that we can do to actually shift consumers and convince them that it's worth the change, the better it would be perhaps in the long run for the environment.
And strangely, your study found people who lean towards conservative politics are more likely to be changed by disasters than those who favor more left or progressive views. Tell us about that, and why do you think this happens?
So if we look at the correlation between climate change beliefs and political ideology, at least in the countries that we examined, which was the United States, countries belonging to Western Europe, and Israel, we found there to be a very strong correlation between climate change beliefs and political ideology. Specifically, those who tend to be more towards the right, they tend to not be less likely to believe that climate change is having an adverse impact on the world, on the environment. So given that, these are most likely to be the people who need convincing that our habits need to change because climate change is actually having an adverse impact on environment in our world. So since leftists, by default, they have strong climate change beliefs usually, they are less likely to, let's say, move even more towards sustainable consumption after experiencing a natural disaster or after the existence of a natural disaster in their community is made salient to them. So that is why we feel like the people who are more towards the right, they have more room to, let's say, increase their sustainable consumption by default, whereas leftists by default perhaps are already at a high enough level where further nudges are less likely to have a meaningful impact.
That's really helpful. So also fascinating in your November 2024 study led by Rebecca Che, the way people react to extreme disasters also depends on regional circumstances. What did you find different in Central and Eastern Europe versus Western Europe?
That's actually a fascinating thing that our investigation found. And essentially our investigation, like I just mentioned, that this effect, it relies on that correlation being there that climate change beliefs are correlated to political ideology, which drives this effect. Now, let's say that was not true, that climate change beliefs has no correlation with political ideology. Then in that case, there shouldn't really be a difference, perhaps, between rightists and leftists in terms of whether their sustainable consumption increases when they feel more vulnerable to natural disasters. And that's exactly what we found in Central and Eastern Europe. As past research has already documented, since that region has developed most of the countries in that region have developed politically in a different way compared to Western Europe, for example, because of the post-communist context of that region, this traditional correlation between climate change beliefs and political ideology is not present over there. Now, because of that, we don't see this interaction effect over there where people who are more towards the right are more likely to increase their sustainable consumption after feeling vulnerable to a natural disaster. So, yes, so it's basically essentially because that association is not present there between climate change beliefs and political ideology that we don't see the effect over there.
And we've been talking about sustainable consumption. Does that mean buying less stuff than before or less than the average American or truly sustainable globally if everybody consumed that much? How do you define sustainable consumption for this paper?
So that is a great point. So sustainable consumption, as you said, can manifest perhaps in different ways. One is that we reduce the quantity of our consumption, that we stick to the bare necessities and we don't overly indulge and we don't buy products unnecessarily and we generally create less waste. The other way to think about it is that there are some products that we definitely need to buy. So for example, we need cars for transportation. At least in most places, a car is required for people to go from one point to the other point. We need to consume food. We need to consume products which involve packaging. So when we, in this investigation at least, we're focusing on that, okay, assuming that consumers actually need these products and they will continue buying these products at a certain level of quantity, can they actually shift their intentions towards a more sustainable version of this? So if it's kind of like if I buy 10 of this item, then keeping that quantity consistent, can I at least buy 10 of this item that is actually more sustainable overall?
I was surprised to find a whole field of study into consumer virtue and consumer vice and how to influence them. Could you explain what those are?
Yes, absolutely. So we can think of virtues and vices as products which differ in terms of whether they have long-term benefits or long-term costs or short-term benefits and short-term costs. So we can define a vice as a product which in the short run is going to give us some benefits. So for example, a chocolate cake. In the short run, it's going to taste great. I'm going to enjoy eating the cake in the moment. However, in the long run, I will be aware that, you know, when I eat the cake, it might have adverse consequences for me in terms of my weight or in terms of my health because the ingredients are not healthy. However, if I eat a salad, in the short run, we can think of it as a cost that it's not going to taste great, but in the long run, it has health benefits. The more I eat of salads rather than something more indulgent like a cake, the better it might be for me in the long run with regards to my health. So virtues tend to have short-run costs, relatively short-run costs, and they tend to be relatively higher on long-term benefits. Vices tend to be relatively higher on short-run benefits, but they tend to be also relatively higher on long-run costs. So that's the way to think about them. And vices and virtues, we can think of them in different ways. We can think of them in terms of our food choices. We can think of them in terms of the experiences we choose to have. Like, you know, maybe watching a movie purely for entertainment versus watching a movie which can actually add to our knowledge, that could also be considered as a vice versus virtue choice. So that, in general, that's what we mean by when we talk about vices and virtues in the consumer literature.
You know, I kind of hate being labeled a consumer. You know, using pros and cons, as we do in language, maybe the opposite would be prosumers. And the prosumer actively does not consume. They don't buy much, and if possible, they don't buy anything. But I guess that, if it really spread, would be bad for business.
Right. So again, in these kinds of contexts, there are always two sides. So one is the consumer welfare side, that what is good for the consumer, and the other, like you mentioned, is what is good for the business. So businesses evolve. They figure out new ways of selling their products and new ways of making their profits. So, for example, the shift towards physical media to digital media is a good example where now physical media does not need to be stored on shelves. Anyone can download it, and there's basically infinite supply. So businesses do evolve and adapt over time to changing consumer demand and changing consumer characteristics. They just need to figure out that which way are consumers headed. So, for example, a company like Netflix was able to realize that streaming movies is the future rather than renting movies in a store. So they were able to get ahead of it and be one of the first movers into the streaming business, and they took advantage of that. So in the same way, if consumers do change their habits towards, you know, being more prosumers, as you put it, and consuming less, then businesses will eventually have to all evolve and adapt to that. So we might think that a move of consumer switching towards a more sustainable lifestyle, consuming less, being more careful about its purchases might be bad for businesses, but in the end, there will be some, the market will adapt, and they will adapt to evolving consumer needs.
And Rafa, you have a fascinating string of papers looking into the way time influences our buying behavior. Why are advertisers always pushing us to buy now or a limited time offer?
That is actually a great point. And the reason is that the ultimate objective is to create a feeling of time pressure. Consumers, they generally tend to make decisions relying on two parts of our brain. So one part is our emotional, quick decision-making brain, and the other one is our slower, rational side. Now, the slower, rational side, in order for it to function, it needs mental resources. It needs mental resources, and it needs time to think. So what advertisers try to do is they try to make us not rely on that rational side. They want us to rely on our emotions. So that's why advertising, in addition to the phrases you mentioned, they also try to show us the product in a very vivid way to create an affective reaction in us so that to arouse our emotions that, you know, this is something I should buy. So the push towards creating limited time offers, or you might also see it in things like, for example, online retailers doing lightning deals where you have basically half an hour to decide, you know, for example, half an hour to decide on whether you buy this or not, after which the deal will be gone. So it is done to create time pressure and to push our brains towards that quicker decision-making style, which relies more on feelings or our rational decision-making. And quite often we give in to our feelings because ultimately emotions and affect, these are mental processes which make us consider mostly the short run. So taking the example of the chocolate cake again, seeing the cake right in front of us, it creates an affective reaction in us. I can see it. I can start imagining what it's going to taste like. And at that moment, I only become concerned with the short run, that what is going to happen right now in the next 20 minutes when I eat the cake. And my brain does not even go towards the future, that what is going to happen a week from now when I will notice that I have gained weight.
Radio EcoShock.
This field of expert business marketing seems a bit scary. I mean, marketing companies can hire experts to read this research like yours, and work it into advertising and sales. It's far less likely that the rest of us will learn about it. Maybe our minds can be manipulated to consume more and so produce more carbon or damage to wildlife and all of that. Can academic work like yours be used for good? I think it can. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely, it can be. And you will see that in marketing journals and consumer behavior journals especially, there is work which relates to how can we get consumers to make decisions that are good for them in the long run. Sustainability research is one example. That's good for the environment, but also it's good for the consumer because ultimately we are citizens of this planet, and consuming in a more sustainable way is going to help the environment and then indirectly the consumer itself. So absolutely, there does exist work which considers consumer welfare. So for example, there is work on happiness, that what leads to consumer happiness. And generally, for example, one of the findings is that experiences make us more happy than material possessions. So there is work existing there, and I do agree with you that getting consumers to learn about this is another challenge, that how can we effectively communicate these findings to the regular consumer. Sometimes press coverage helps with that, so that's one of the ways to get that message across. But yes, there are findings out there, but they are slow to make their way towards the consumer.
I just want to tell listeners about another paper published in November 2024 in Nature. The title is How Natural Disasters and Environmental Fears Shape American Climate Attitudes Across Political Orientation. They have similar findings as your work, but this time they're not really looking into consumption, but beliefs about climate change. They say, quote, results support hypotheses that conservatives demonstrate lower climate concern and that fear of natural and environmental disasters increases climate concern, end quote. So maybe humans have to learn the hard way, but given what California just went through, this could be the real hard way. What do you think it will take to really shift our buying habits and our desire to have a greener life?
I think that's a great point. So yes, unfortunately, maybe it will take a little bit of direct experience, like you said, which can shift consumer attitudes. The other thing, which is the greater challenge, and I'm not sure how soon something like that can happen, but it will require a lot of work, is dissociating ideology with concepts like climate change. I think, unfortunately, when a person's personal political ideology or worldviews start to get associated with their beliefs in climate change because of various reasons, that's where the real problem starts happening. Because, so for example, there's this field in consumer literature about a consumer's identity. So all of us, we identify ourselves with different groups. You know, it could be as simple as the school I go to, the workplace I am at, the city I live in. These are all part of our identity. And part of that identity is also the political group that I align with. And if I'm aligning with a political group which is telling me that, for example, that climate change is not real, then it becomes part of my identity. Now, whether I truly believe that or not in earnest becomes irrelevant. Because I identify with that group, I start behaving similar to that group because I want to maintain group membership. If I show behavior which deviates from the group, I might be, you know, I might think that, okay, they might exclude me from the group, or if I want to maintain my group membership, identify with these people, I have to do the same thing that they're doing. That's the real challenge. If group identity is defined by beliefs in, you know, things that are fundamentally, let's say, harmful to the environment or to the consumer, then it becomes a problem, and then that is harder to overcome, and that will require a change in thought, a change in communication, and more clear, effective communication. I believe there's also some research which says that if an impartial source can be conveyed to the consumer, that this is completely impartial, free from any ideology, it is completely based on independent scientific research, and the scientists are not aligned with any political ideology, then they become more likely to believe those findings. So that's the key thing, that conveying findings in a very, very impartial way and making the consumer believe that these findings are impartial and not aligned with their ideology, then maybe those beliefs based on group identity can actually be overcome.
Rafi, you're in a remarkable spot. You're a relatively young person, at least compared to me, with a changing climate ahead. California is already rocked by extreme events. You teach in a business school in a state where people believe green business is really possible. How do you see your future work unfolding? What are you going to do next?
So my main research area is time. And this then, you know, branches out into things like self-control, which are decisions related to, let's say, the choices people make with regards to whether something is good for them in the long run or bad for them in the long run, and then it extends to things like sustainability, because ultimately sustainability relates to considerations about the future. So one work I am working on is how thinking about the future affects our sustainable consumption decisions. So, for example, one finding in one of my recent experiments is that ultimately when we see sustainable products or we see sustainability cues attached to products, it does make us focus more on the future by default for most people. But when we start focusing on the future, one harm that might have is that we might delay our sustainable consumption, because we might feel like, okay, sustainability, this is making me think about the future, and perhaps because I'm thinking about the future, I don't immediately engage in sustainable consumption. So the context I show that in is intertemporal choice, which is a concept where consumers might face a choice between getting a product now versus getting a product later. So just to give you an example, let's say they were buying a vehicle which is sustainable, which let's say runs on electricity, has a low carbon footprint, and they could buy one now or they could buy one later. So if the sustainability related information with that product is making them think about the future, they might feel like, I can wait and delay consumption of this product. Because thinking about the future, they feel like, okay, you know, the future is not, I can still wait for this product. So ultimately, the goal is that, and we also are trying to show that in that project, that if we can make consumers think that sustainability is an issue of the present rather than the future, then this effect of delaying sustainable consumption might go away. Because it's one thing to convey sustainability-related information about our product or in general. It's another thing to learn, okay, what effect does that have on the thinking of the consumer? So what we want to do ultimately is create interventions, communications, which make people believe that, no, this is actually very real and it's happening right now. This is not something that we are thinking of as a future consequence, that in the future at some point the environment is going to go bad. No, what we need to convey is that it's already happened. It's an issue of the present, so that people, when they see sustainable products, they are made to think about the present rather than the future, and that they don't delay their sustainable consumption.
Okay. You've just given me a new slogan, and it is, climate change is now.
Yes.
We won't talk about climate change in the future. And we can really say that, looking at what's happening right now. From Santa Clara University, Levy School of Business, we've been speaking with Rafi Siddiqui. He's the assistant professor of marketing there. And you can find links to this new study on disasters and consumption in my show blog, Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Rafi, thanks for helping us out. I really appreciated talking with you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. And it was great talking to you.
For Radio EcoShock, I'm Alex Smith.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Over 1,300 people died in extreme heat during the Hajj in Mecca 2024. But experts can only guess how many people die each year from climate-driven extremes. We do not know the cumulative long-term toll of repeated attacks on our health due to climate change, and this is a big knowledge gap. Professor Dan Mitchell just published Why We Still Don't Know the Mounting Health Risks of Climate Change. Dan is professor of climate science at the Cabot Institute for the Environment at the University of Bristol, UK. From Bristol, Dan Mitchell, welcome to Radio EcoShock. Your article was published by the premier journal Nature in January. You make a point that may be new to some of our listeners and doctors. What do you mean by cumulative health effects during climate disruption? At this point, there was a problem in my studio which made Dan's first response hard to understand. I'm going to read out his reply and then we resume the interview as it should be. Dan said, during my article, I'm very clear that we should start distinguishing between fast and violent, so things like heat waves or storms or cold snaps, from slow onset events, so things like gradual rising of the background temperature or persistent air pollution changes from different wildfire locations. And so really what I mean by cumulative effects is how do those combinations of different disasters mount up to account for a sort of invisible toll of mortality, which is not, perhaps, seen on TV, the news, that sort of thing, because it's a longer-term thing to capture. So that was what Dan Mitchell said, and now we go to our full interview. Well, let's take one example. Here in the West, we tend to breathe a lot of wildfire smoke, especially in the last few years. It's even worse if a city burns like Los Angeles, where the cities are full of toxic plastics and chemicals. It may not kill us directly, but is there evidence wildfire smoke could make us very sick or lead to death later? Is that the sort of thing you're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, there is evidence that wildfire smoke will kill directly, actually. If someone's particularly prone to respiratory illness, they might be a very strong asthmatic. You can see that happen immediately. That person would probably go to A&E first and then die later in hospital. But yes, my main point is that actually cumulative exposure of air pollution like that over a long period, we know there are significant poor health outcomes from that. What we don't know are the absolute numbers on how many people are getting iller, what the number of years of life lost, for instance, for people in these populations. So, where you guys are in the West, then it's not just about where the wildfires are burning. It's about where the winds are blowing the pollutants, and these can be hundreds of kilometers downstream of the fires, for instance.
And you also write about heat waves and kidney disease. I was unaware of that connection. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, so kidneys can respond in very, very unique ways, I guess, to certain stressors. So if you get electrolyte imbalance, if you become dehydrated, for instance, then kidneys can be damaged. And so when we talk about kidney disease, we're talking about essentially worsening kidney function over time. And sometimes these things can be quite sudden. You know, something can go inside you and you would go into A&E, for instance. But often it's just making these things work in a poorer way. And so a lot of maybe developed countries, you see more kidney disease because of prolonged droughts. And those sort of things filter through when you get extreme events, but there's a background health change as well.
Are we seeing evidence of these cumulative health impacts in excess death statistics, or how would we know?
In terms of looking at the actual mortality data and long-term exposures, it would be extremely difficult to quantify this. And this is sort of my point in the paper, is you need decades of reliable health data before you would see a signal like this. So the real issue is, if we want to wait for some of that, then we're going to have to wait for more decades, and then we can go back and say, oh yes, all that exposure occurring 30, 40, 50 years ago was having really bad effects. So one of the points of the paper is, if we've got strong physiological evidence for this sort of thing, then we should be including these in our risk assessments already. So one example is, for instance, we know air pollution, if you breathe it in directly through your nose, it can directly impact on your brain. So we know that there's a link between dementia and air pollution. Now, if you were to calculate the number of people who dementia is being progressed more quickly because of this, that number doesn't exist. We don't have the sort of data you would need to calculate that number, which is a problem because it means we can't include it in climate change risk assessments. However, we know that it is a problem because we've seen it in certain case studies, we've seen it in the lab, we've seen it when we've looked at people's brains who've been exposed to these things. So we know it's happening, but we can't quantify it, so it doesn't appear in our assessments, and that's a real problem.
In one of your earlier studies, you looked at wildfire risks in the United Kingdom. Now, I don't usually think of the jolly green land as the spot of wildfires, but what did you find?
No, exactly right. So, I mean, there are thousands of wildfires in the UK every year, actually, but they're, they're not nearly as dramatic as what other countries, especially the LA wildfires or Australia, Turkey, those sort of regions. They're much smaller field fires or moorland fires. But in the case of our study, there was a larger wildfire and it did start burning buildings on the outskirts of London. So we've got a lot of interest here. So yeah, countries like the UK can have wildfires, but they're significantly less of a risk than many other countries, like Turkey, for instance.
We'll be right back with more from Dr. Dan Mitchell from the University of Bristol, speaking about the health cost of repeated climate stressors.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We're back with Dr. Dan Mitchell talking about your health and climate change. Well, speaking of extreme heat, though, you also co-authored a study finding scorching heat over 50 degrees C is rapidly increasing in parts of the Mediterranean and the Middle East due to human influence. That was published a year before Greece hit 44 degrees C in June 2024. The Acropolis had to close and tourists, including British tourists, died in the heat, like the British TV presenter Michael Mosley. Several places in the Middle East did hit 50 degrees Celsius, that's 122 Fahrenheit, during the 2024 summer. So what are your expectations having done that previous study?
Yeah, well, it's exactly as you say, you know, 50 degrees, there's nothing special that happens at 50 degrees Celsius, but it is economically a very important number. So a lot of countries actually have 50 degrees as a threshold where they'll stop outdoor workers, they'll still pay them, for instance, so it's an economic thing, and a lot of alert systems go into place. So it's a very important number structurally for many countries, especially countries, say, in the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, those sort of countries where you can get those sort of temperatures. So it was important to show that rise and the fact that countries in southern Europe would start to see some of these things. As you rightfully said, during particularly hot extreme, then Michael Mosley unfortunately passed away due to heat stress. Now, he was an incredibly well-informed doctor. He knew this stuff as much as anyone, and yet he still, you know, heat stress still got him, and that really goes to show that these things are lethal and you have to take them very seriously, even though you can be very well informed. His situation was a bit different because he got lost on a trail, but still we often say things like carrying extra water and things like that can really help save lives here.
And scientists on this program and everywhere are saying extreme events will be worse and will come more often due to greenhouse changes. And another worry we have here is that it could affect babies in the womb. It's dangerous for pregnant women. And then, of course, the babies may be affected for life afterwards. Did you talk about that in your short article in Nature?
Yeah, so the effect of weather and weather-related stress on pregnancy is becoming a much larger area of research. You know, in a sense, every one of the mothers listening to your program will know that it's incredibly stressful when you're pregnant. And in normal stress situations, then you can feel it even more so. So there's a clear logical reason to think that if you're pregnant and a huge heat wave is going off, things are going to get bad. There have been some direct studies, though, that which have followed the child once it's been born through actually decades of its life after very stressful in utero weather event conditions. Some has been the Canadian outage, the storms in 1998 in Quebec. There's a cohort of children that have been followed from that event. And so that was a month of power outages during a very large snowstorm, for instance, in Quebec. And they saw that later down the line, 20 years down the line, these children had higher mental health problems compared to other children born at that time, including things like anxiety and depression and PTSD.
They say people can die of a broken heart, and do we know whether just stressing about storms or heat waves actually leads to poor health? Dan, does news of disasters possibly damage us even if we don't go through them personally?
Disasters can make people upset, that's true. I think that the bigger problem is probably this idea of climate anxiety. So that's the idea that climate change as a whole is going to bring particularly problematic weather conditions. In some cases, people talk about not having a future, or the Earth as we know it's going to be very different. And I think there's a communication problem there. Very few real scientists are saying that climate change is going to end the world, or it's just not a livable future for most of us. What we're saying is things are getting worse. We're saying that everyone's health will be impacted in a way, and maybe you have to take more precautions. Maybe you need to spend more of your money on adaptation. Maybe you need to be more wary of communities which don't have a lot of money, especially in the developing world. And I think some people have taken this idea a bit too far, and they kind of feel like they can't have a family because the world's going to be too bad in the future. That's absolutely not what the science is saying. The science is saying that overwhelmingly, a world population, we will be worse off. And it's something we should try and avoid as much as possible. But it's definitely not the end of things. It's just making life more difficult. And I think we need to communicate those points more clearly. There's no doubt that acting now, stopping climate change, will save lives, and it will save a hell of a lot of money. But, yeah, there's a nuance there that should be made quite clear. And I think especially some of our younger climate change supporters may be thinking that we're saying something a bit more world-ending than we actually are in this case.
Well, humans have a tendency for that. People have been talking about that since the Middle Ages and before, that the end of the world is coming and they expect it. Now, I would like to add a note for our listeners. It's news about another study finding climate change is linked to worsening brain diseases. In June, a big team of medical professionals published a study on climate change and disorders of the nervous system. It was in The Lancet Neurology. They say, quote, evidence suggests that the incidence, prevalence, and severity of many nervous system conditions, for example, stroke, neurological infections, and some mental health disorders, can be affected by climate change, end quote. So we can add brain damage and mental health problems possibly to climate change. Does that fit in with what you know, Dan?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if you really step back and think about this problem, we as humans have evolved to the weather on our planet. That's how evolution works. Climate change is changing that weather at a very rapid rate. So just from a basic logical standpoint, we're so ingrained with the weather and everything that we do that if we change that in a quick way, it becomes very clear as to how this might affect every aspect of our health. And our job as scientists is really to try and quantify that, try and come up with solutions which mitigate against that.
And the new concept in your Nature article, and this probably applies to a lot of living things, so well beyond humans, it's repeated trauma from ongoing climate disasters may add up to significant tolls on our health. That sounds important for medical practitioners, but also governments trying to plan responses. Dan, why don't we know more about this?
There are a couple of different pathways. The first is when you start thinking about things in the longer term, our models become infinitely more complex. And you could see that if you took a single person, if they were exposed to a flash flood, which typically occurs over a couple of hours, you could very clearly say what's happened to that person during that flood. However, if you took that same person and said, well, let's trace their life over the next 30 or 40 years and see how climate has changed their life, you would have to know exactly where they've been, which countries they've lived in, have they spent more time indoors or outdoors. All of these other sort of causal factors come into play, and it becomes much more difficult to say, yes, the increase in temperature alone was what caused these problems in this person. It could be the fact that person is getting older, and in older people, they see those problems. It could be that at some point in their life, they develop some sort of infection which makes them much more susceptible to certain things. It could be that they started off in a very rich family but went into poverty. All of these other socioeconomic factors, these geographical factors, are really hard to disentangle over the longer term. But on the shorter term, for say the flash flood or the short heat wave, then you know all of these at that instant. And that's one of the real problems with this longer term burden.
From your time as a research scientist at Oxford, you worked on a range of climate issues, such as the polar vortex, for example. What steered you toward investigating the health impacts of climate change?
Well, the health impacts are some of the most direct things we can see for climate change. There's also so much to be done on the methods to really understand these pathways. You mentioned the paper about brain damage in The Lancet. You know, that's a very significant finding that was not particularly well known before. And it's such a rapidly moving field that we're always finding these sort of connections that perhaps we didn't even think about beforehand. And so it makes it a very important field to be in at the moment. It's also the one area where we really feel we can go to our governments around the world and we can point at data and we can say, look, here's the amount of people dying because of inaction of climate change. Here's what you can do to help prevent them die. And by the way, you should be cutting carbon emissions as well, because otherwise you're just putting a plaster over the problem. Clearly, that doesn't work with every government. I'm not going to mention names, but I'm sure your viewers can guess who I'm talking about. One of the real issues is governments often come in cycles, often 4 or 5 year cycles, and what one government might want to do or invest in is not necessarily what another one might be, and that really slows the progress towards net zero.
Well, as we wrap this up, is there anything else you would like listeners to know about climate change and their health?
The only thing I would say is there's a lot you can do personally for your own health. And, you know, heat waves is one of the biggest killers globally. There's quite a bit people can do just to prevent these sorts of things. In that case, it might be checking up on elderly relatives. It might be drinking more water. It might be changing the way you open or close windows or curtains in your house, for instance. So for a lot of these problems, there are pretty logical and simple solutions. That's absolutely not always the case, especially for populations in poorer parts of the world. But my point to your viewers are there's a lot you can do yourselves to make your families and your close friends resilient to these sort of extreme events. It's not all about governments or other organizations doing it.
From the University of Bristol, we've been speaking with Professor Dan Mitchell. You can find links to all the science we just talked about in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Dan, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
A stun grenade, also called a flashbang, suddenly overloads our senses. We cannot react. Isn't that how it is right now? That is the state of human affairs and the natural world. Load up a continuing pandemic, unbearable heat, city burning wildfires, big storms, vandals in government, fearful markets, worried people. We are stunned. And the name for that is polycrisis. It is not temporary. It is a byproduct of superindustrializing in overdrive. As Adam Tooze, the British historian and professor at Columbia University, explains, A polycrisis doesn't just happen, it is made.
Economics, politics, geopolitics, and then the natural environment blowing back at us. That's why I think the polycrisis term has a real utility. And then it was picked up by Jean-Claude Juncker, the president of the European Commission, in 2015, 2016 to describe the experience of trying to govern Europe when you had to deal with the Greek debt crisis, Putin's first aggression against Ukraine, and the sort of rumblings of Brexit in the background, and the refugee crisis in Syria spilling over into Europe. And I think what he was trying to get at, and why I think the term is still useful, is this experience of not a single crisis with a single clearly defined logic, the financial crisis, and it's about mortgage-backed securities and they're blowing up, but this coming together at a single moment of things which, on the face of it, and really when you even dig into it, don't have anything to do with each other, but nevertheless seem to pile on to each other to create a situation in the minds of policymakers, business people, families, individuals, when we're thinking about the COVID crisis, for instance, that is overwhelming and that leaves us unable to cope and, you know, questioning our identity and finding it very difficult to decide what the ground is that we stand on, because it's being destabilized from so many different directions at once. And there are different versions of, I think, this experience, especially if you live in North America, if you live in the United States. Americans have been experienced, certainly liberal Americans, I think conservatives feel it too, a kind of sense of national crisis that's quite comprehensive, but they read it as the experience of the American dream coming apart. Whereas I think the polycrisis concept captures this as a much more general experience. And I think in the last, I wouldn't confine it to the last couple of years. Juncker said it started in 1516. I think you could make a good case that really the unfolding of this current moment starts in 2008, which is simultaneously not just the financial crisis, which we all remember, but also Putin's first aggression against Georgia. It is also the breakdown of the WTO in the Doha round. It is setting the stage for the disappointment of the Copenhagen climate talks. And then on top of everything else, there was a swine flu epidemic in 2008-9. And so in a sense, you already see there many of the elements of the current moment coming together. And the key things for me are finance, politics, if you like, the disruptions of American democratic politics with Sarah Palin being put on the GOP ticket in 08. So economics, politics, geopolitics, and then the natural environment blowing back at us. And those four things, they don't reduce to a single common denominator, right? They don't reduce to a single factor. And that's why I think the polycrisis term has a real utility, descriptively as much as anything else, because it's kind of hand-waving. Of course, it's kind of arm-waving. It's going, look, there's a lot of stuff happening here all at once. And that precisely is what we're trying to get our wrap our minds around. And as the Club of Rome report and various types of epidemiological expertise were saying at the time, the dawning awareness that the miracle of economic growth, which had been, you know, really taken off in a dramatic scale after World War II, has a downside. So that a series of really very dramatic risks are not just merely exogenous anymore, but are being generated by the very success of our economic growth story. And that awareness really comes quite sharply into focus, both on the, shall we say, resource environmental envelope side, but also on the pandemic disease zoonotic mutation side in the 1970s. And so that, for me, would be the moment where the modern polycrisis mode becomes visible, this first beginning to be articulated. And if you take Edgar Morin, so the French theorist who first coined the term, if you take his intellectual biography back, he's a classic 1970s environmental alarmist.
Wait a minute. Speaking to the wealthy movers and shakers at Davos, Adam Tooze claims the inventor of the polycrisis concept was a classic 1970s alarmist. Actually, it's too bad we did not listen enough to the French theorist of complexity, Edgar Morin. At the time of this broadcast, Edgar is still alive at the age of 103 in Paris. He is the author of over 60 books, not many of them in English. A polymath who contributed to everything from media studies to ecology and systems biology. Morin is recognized as a pioneer in complexity and complex thought. He is a founder of transdisciplinary work. Bring me many more such alarmists, please. For me, Adam Tooze is not suggesting a carefully planned conspiracy to create this pack of converging threats. While there may be actors who temporarily capitalize on these civilizational threats, the total package is produced by all of us in a system which is destabilizing due to unplanned and somewhat unforeseen consequences. The Cabal at the top struggles in the whirlwind just as we do, blown even harder, perhaps, than the peasants below. We've covered the polycrisis extensively on Radio EcoShock. I recommend our program, Coping in the Polycrisis, broadcast in March 2023. I had systems and security expert Homer Dixon on here. Listen to that program right from my website at ecoshock.org, or download it free to your own device and listen later.
With the work of the Columbia University historian Adam Tooze, the concept's been getting a lot of airtime in his blogs and Substack blogs, and also a lot of conversation at the World Economic Forum, as just kind of a general label for the fact that the world seems to be incredibly chaotic, and we're being, as you suggested, hit by one shock after another. A lot of them related, of course, to climate change, but then we had the pandemic and the financial and economic consequences of the pandemic, food crisis that was aggravated by the pandemic and also by the Ukraine-Russia war and the war itself, of course. And it seems like all of this stuff is happening. I think a lot of the commentators, including those at the World Economic Forum, think of this as just a, in a sense, bad luck. You know, just a lot of stuff happens to be going wrong simultaneously, and we'll weather it, we'll move beyond it, and life will get back to something like normal. We're arguing in our work that actually the coincidence of crises is not a coincidence. In other words, there are underlying mechanisms that are driving the synchronization of a lot of these crises that we don't fully understand. So we haven't unpacked the causal dynamics entirely, but it's not just chance that a whole bunch of things are going wrong simultaneously.
Homer Dixon is director and founder of the Cascade Institute in British Columbia, and he operates the helpful website at polycrisis.org. But is the convenient catch-all label of polycrisis, beloved at Davos, COP27, and all the elite functions, is it really a distraction from the fundamental ecological mega-crisis? Doesn't it make climate change or species extinction just one of many concurrent problems like migration or inflation or many human-only issues? In his 2023 discussion at the World Economic Forum at Davos, Adam Tooze says he is a Keynesian, using economic theory developed by John Maynard Keynes. Keynes is the architect of democratic economies, including ways to survive the Great Depression of the 1930s. He advocates government intervention. Bailouts and Green New Deals ever since draw on Keynes' work. Here, Tooze describes the Keynesian technique of breaking down the polycrisis into a series of subthoughts called a black box.
And what's so interesting about Keynes is he has a politics of black boxing. So he's generally speaking a Democrat in favor of trying to maintain democracy and its functioning in a very fragile moment in the 20s and 30s. But to do that, what he thinks is that you need to take certain problems off the agenda. So the problem of unemployment or the problem of excessively high interest rates and uncompetitiveness can be addressed by economic policy. So what he's trying to offer is a set of technical fixes that allow you to take those issues off the board so that then you can concentrate the limited scope there is, the limited political capital is, the building consensus or just function democracy on issues which are harder to resolve and where genuine political agreement is needed. And that seems to me to be a model for thinking about our current moment.
Can we really pull out connected pieces to apply a technical fix? Can we take COVID or climate change off the table for now to focus on other things? Doesn't that make them both more dangerous? Anyway, all the parts of the polycrisis interact and then morph into other states. I worry some Greens tend to put the environment in a black box, leaving out things like inequality or wealth or racial injustice, because those aren't our issues. We just want to concentrate to solve global warming to get clean air and clean water. But can that ever happen in a dictatorship or a fascist corporate state? Beware of black boxes, that's all I'm saying. Tooze may take comfort in psychoanalysis and promote his liberal Keynesian economics, but I think that's a little too late, too late. He offers a comforting formula as though we can control ourselves or our fate now that this grand experiment with the atmosphere has been launched on Earth. Keynesian thinking and even the Green New Deal may be archaic thought systems from the time before the Anthropocene and the Great Acceleration, before artificial intelligence and global communication, before human systems began their flight into the sun with wings attached of wax. Call us doomers or realists, natural systems and our own madness will most likely force massive degrowth and depopulation on us one way or another, sooner or later. Nothing can grow forever on a finite planet. This horrible but required reset may be already underway. Real choices, such as they are, assuming we survive as a species with some knowledge, will be made after, and likely not by most of us sharing these thoughts today. So that is where post-doom thought and belief begin. We started this program with radical uncertainty. Imagine landing a large passenger plane in a dense fog. You have instruments and radar, all provided by science, as our guide. We need to land this crazy heat engine, despite the fog of uncertainty and unknowable consequences. Destabilized life requires radical action to decelerate, to reach terra firma safely again. In coming shows, we explore a plausible driver of current human failure, brain rot. We always presume humans are getting more intelligent. The news suggests otherwise. Are we getting stupider? Stay tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. This is a climate emergency. Thank you for listening and caring about this world.
It seems like God or some chaotic power. I don't know when. Nobody knows if we see it again. Dark luck just waiting to light it up. We run on fumes to the grocery store. Burn that tar from the down below.